if war is politics by other means, if the purpose of war is to achieve political objectives, in order to figure out whether you can win a war and what you need to win a war, you have to know what those political objectives are.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm David Rothkopf, CEO and editor, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in Washington today, and we're joined by FP columnist Rosa Brooks, senior Future of War fellow at New America, professor at Georgetown University, and author of How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, and Colin Kahl, who is heading up FP's shadow government blog with Julie Smith and Derek Chollet. He's currently a professor at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service in the Security Studies program. ER nerds, we have some awesome new mugs that we're debuting. Send us your ideas or a sad, sad sob story, and you may be one of the lucky ones. And the mugs are fantastic. We have one that says Team Rosa, and we have one that says Team Corey, and then one that no one's going to want that says you're absolutely right, David. And then there's one that says Undersecretary of Snark. And if you want one of these in particular, make a good case. You know, and then every week I'll tell Rosa and Corey who wins, you know, who gets the most requests. It'll be fantastic.
I'm afraid that one of us is going to get voted off the island, David. Yeah. I don't like this competitive spirit that's rising up in
the
ER.
That's the way it is. It's everything is Hunger Games.
That's my fear.
Everything. That's what Washington has turned.
All this winning feels like.
Yeah, that's what this winning feels like. Is exactly right. This is the capital. In Hunger Games.
So it's the capital of the deep state.
It really is. It really is. Anyway, email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. Recently, in our tiny podcast studio, high above Washington's DuPont Circle, you know, right at the Deep State Cafe, which my mother, when I said it on the last podcast, thought I said the Beefcake Cafe, which it is not, although Colin looks really great today.
You really do look great today, Colin.
It's the tight, despite the tight T-shirt, this is not the Beefcake.
Yeah, he's come in here all oiled up from the gym. Anyway, we had the...
Boy, this studio is small.
Yeah, really. Sometimes it feels smaller than others. We had the following conversation. So, you know, we talk about what's going on each week. Here's something that I noticed that's going on that doesn't seem to be getting a lot of press, although in my day, this is the kind of story that would. I saw in the course of 36 hours a story about deploying Marines to Syria. I saw a story about deploying Rangers to Syria. I saw a story about deploying thousands of more troops to Afghanistan. We already know that we sent in special ops to Yemen, which was Colin's idea in the last administration, and
busted.
And they just did it. And when asked about all of this, the Trump administration, when asked about the Marines going into Syria, the Trump administration says that the president has been made aware of this.
Yes, the good news and the bad news is that someone else is apparently running our foreign policy, not the White House.
Right. Well, that is the good news and the bad news. But, you know, the president has been made aware of the fact that troops have been deployed.
That was nice of Jim Mattis to let him know. I appreciate that.
But, like, what's going on? We're like, this is, if Barack Obama had sent one Marine within 30 miles of Syria, it would have caused, like, you know, protests in the street, insanity. And in the past week, we've done more escalating in this region than at any time since the surge. Or am I getting that wrong?
Well, I think two things are intersecting. One is you have an administration that made as one of its central foreign policy pillars, such that you can talk about anything that's related to Trump in a degree of intellectual coherence, kind of battling radical Islamic terrorism writ large, which is kind of every group from the Islamic State to Al-Qaeda to the Muslim Brotherhood to Iran.
To Muhammad Ali's son,
correct.
Apparently.
That's right. To include probably most devout Muslims in the United States as well. But nevertheless, they've obviously made this a signature item. The other thing that they talked a lot about during the transition, frankly, and that they've tried to execute is to, you know, stop the micromanaging from the White House to the Pentagon that the Obama administration was so prone to do. And I think these two things have collided to basically give the Pentagon a lot more room, basically, to escalate across a number of conflicts. And we're seeing this in Yemen. We've already had more airstrikes against against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, this group in Yemen. Put aside the raid for a moment. You've seen just more airstrikes in this so far this year than you saw from Obama all of last year. You also are – it's looking like we're going to double our contingent of forces in Syria from about 500 special operations forces to include, you know, 400 or 500 additional forces to include Marines and Rangers. And then not surprisingly, you had General Votel up on the Hill saying that they'll likely have a recommendation to have more forces in Afghanistan. And I will tell you, as someone who worked all of these issues in the Obama administration, the military will always tell you they want more forces in Afghanistan because they have, the Afghans will never be good enough to do what they need to do. They're losing terrain, and there will always be reason for more GIs on the ground. So what's interesting is you've got this escalation across the board with very little public conversation, very little debate, and as far as I can tell, almost no process on the inside of the Trump administration. And that's a recipe for mission creep, quagmire, getting people killed, and getting more deeply involved in some of the messiest conflicts on earth.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, as usual, whenever we talk about things like, well, are these too many troops? Are these not enough troops? The more important question is, well, what are you actually trying to do? If you're trying to permanently hold terrain throughout Afghanistan and keep both ISIS and the Taliban from gaining a foothold, then the amount of troops we have is not nearly enough. We need hundreds of thousands, more or less, forever, or at least for the next decade or so. I think what we haven't seen in this administration yet at all, at least in public, is any real conversation about, well, what's the goal here? You know, we're gonna win wars from now on, but what does that actually mean in terms of our political objectives? I mean, this is the most sort of basic strategic question in the original book, the book by Clausewitz, which we all love, or by Clausewitz's wife, as the case may be. If war is politics by other means, if the purpose of war is to achieve political objectives, in order to figure out whether you can win a war and what you need to win a war, you have to know what those political objectives are. And it does seem pretty clear that although I would like to assume that in various little pockets in the Pentagon, people are having that conversation, it doesn't seem to be connected to the White House, and it certainly doesn't seem to be connected to Congress or to the American people. And just to flag one other issue, as far as I know, there's been no discussion of War Powers Act notification to Congress of sending these additional U.S. troops into places such as Syria. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out and whether Congress decides it cares or not.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say on that, I think that, you know, the administration would probably make the same argument the Obama administration did, which is that it's covered under the authorizations for the use of military force against al-Qaeda, of which AQAP in Yemen, obviously elements within Afghanistan and in Syria, the Islamic State, which grew out of al-Qaeda in Iraq, et cetera, et cetera.
But which is as much of a stretch for this administration as it was for
the
last.
The Republicans on the Hill would have gone and been talking about the War Powers Act before, and now they're completely silent. But, you know, what strikes me also as I look at this is back in the days before we were broadcasting from the Deep State Cafe, when this was just the epicenter of the blog, I'm sorry to say.
You mean the blob, not the blog. Blob, the blog, too. But,
yeah, but when this was the epicenter of the blob, we were sometimes a little bit critical of the Obama administration.
I never was, David. That was all you.
Yeah. Oh, no. Now you're just kissing up to Colin. But
he's a beefcake.
Because of the beefcake, exactly. That's actually his Twitter handle, Colin.
That's going to be his mug,
beefcake,
too.
Beefcake, call, yeah. But because of the sense that the Obama administration had overlearned the lessons of the Bush administration, right? But here we have the Trump administration that seems to have unlearned the lessons of both administrations, both Bush and Obama, by going in without a plan, going in without a process, going in without any public debate, going in without a mission. So this is, you know, I mean, I was really sure back when I knew that Hillary Clinton was going to win, I knew she was going to win because we had gone from antithesis, thesis with Bush to antithesis with Obama, and that Hillary was going to be kind of synthesis, that she was going to kind of balance things out a little bit. But instead, what we've ended up with is this just, you know, kind of off its hinges approach of the Trump administration where literally, he's sort of setting aside the past 16 years.
Yeah, I mean, I like your Hegelian reference, by the way. I think we went from thesis
impressive.
To antithesis. I think we're now in non-tithesis or non-synthesis or something like that.
Non-synthesis.
Exactly right. Try saying that three times fast. Look, I think in those three domains that you mentioned, you know, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Syria, that the part where there's probably is the most strategy is on the Syria side, because obviously Secretary Mattis came to the White House about a week ago, provided his strategic review of the counter-Islamic State campaign. And part of that, the next stage in Syria is taking Raqqa. And these forces are basically the next ratchet of escalation to provide artillery fires and some ground and some support for the coalition of Kurds and Arabs that will probably take Raqqa. I think the reason why you haven't seen more flash and them kind of rolling out in a big way the strategy, which is probably more what the Obama team would have done, is because I think they're afraid to do that in a way that alienates the Turks right now prior to the referendum that Erdogan
I think the Turks are going to be good at getting alienated all by themselves,
right,
though.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think they're trying to. It's a pity that their guy
they're
Flynn.
They're alienating like crazy.
It's a pity their guy Flynn isn't in there pitching for him as they were paying.
If I could get $500,000 to write a single op-ed,
well, but apparently they want their money back. Apparently, they don't think that Flynn did such a great job. And indeed, I can see why they might feel that way at this point.
That's true. And by the way, listeners, this should dispel your notion that Colin gets $500,000. For the op-eds that he writes for us, because he doesn't. Rose does.
But he
does not.
We should.
You should, definitely. You know, I don't mean to put you on the spot here, Colin, but let me push back just a little bit on that. I don't know how we can say it's a strategy in Syria if we don't have a long-term goal. And there's no sign of a long-term goal in Syria, right? It seems like if you are fighting ISIS and ISIS is holed up in Raqqa, and you want to declare some kind of progress, then go blow up Raqqa. But that's tactical. It's not strategic.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that's fair at some level. It clearly, you know, there's an overall campaign to disrupt, dismantle, defeat. I guess Trump now says demolish. There must be some other D words.
Squash.
You know, make
the Islamic State.
Yeah.
We used to call them ISIL. He calls them ISIS. The Arabs call them Daesh, whatever, this group. These are tactical and operational objectives. The near-term question that they had to confront, which they're wrestling with now, and there's a good Wall Street Journal piece on this recently kind of going over some of this debate, is kind of how do you go after Raqqa? Because unlike in Iraq, where we have local forces and a government we can work with, in Syria we don't have the same type of scenario, and so it's kind of a game of pickup basketball, and the only players on the floor at the moment are the Syrian Democratic Forces, this kind of mishmash of Syrian Kurds and Arabs. But you're right. It's not clear to me what the broader play is here, especially as it relates to this civil war in Syria, which is driving extremism and now is taking on ever more complicated dimensions as the Russians and the Turks flirt with one another, and they're both engaged in northwest Syria as the regime consolidates its position in certain places, as we're really active in northern Syria, as the Jordanians and the Israelis are doing things in the south. It's a completely it's a very complex mosaic, and it's not clear to me they've thought at all about how whatever they do vis-a-vis the Islamic State in Syria links up to any goal, diplomatic or otherwise, as it relates to Syria. And I don't even know who would run that place since there's not much of a State Department.
Well, there's not much of a State Department. It's still the best line, and the one that we've quoted in almost every episode since she uttered it was Rose's line about Rex Tillerson being on a milk carton at this point.
Yeah, I think I stole that line from somebody else, but now I can't remember who. But it was a good line.
He is a brilliant mix of aloofness and inconsequentialness.
Well, I mean,
wow.
I think
that's,
so.
That's a 1-2 punch.
Part of what's so weird about what's going on is it feels like there's no unitary U.S. government. I mean, we all complained during the Obama administration, not all of us perhaps, Colin, but many of us complained about sort of over-centralization of decision-making in the White House.
In Colin's office.
Only when Colin was at DOD.
Colin was the mastermind, puppeteer.
But here now I feel like we have sort of multiple different U.S. governments which appear to have different processes and perhaps different goals. I mean, Tillerson seems to be non-existent, completely non-existent. So his goal seems to be to, you know, cease to exist, which is not so great for the State Department, but leave that aside.
I Colin, before we started recording, was referring to my Twitter activity, for which I'm ashamedly admit to, And one of the things that I said the other day was that I knew somebody, and I didn't mention it in the tweet, but the person was a now deceased congressman who I thought a lot of, who used to refer to Warren Christopher as the black hole of charisma. And I said that given his recent performance, Tillerson is making Christopher look like Axl Rose.
You know,
at least he was there.
Well, but we have in the Pentagon, we have Jim Mattis, who clearly is pursuing goals, which I could take a guess at articulating what his goals are based on his prior comments and so forth. He's not a guy who thinks the Russians are warm and fuzzy. And then we also have Trump and Kushner and Bannon in the White House who seem to be having their own meetings with random foreign leaders at which they say and do random things, which they don't clear with anybody beforehand. And so Mattis is surprised and Tillerson knows nothing about it and so forth. So it's not... It almost seems at times as though the goals of the White House and perhaps the goals of other parts of the U.S. government are becoming increasingly incompatible and in contradiction. And that may, you know, explain why we have this baffling set of actions that nobody has explained.
Well, and also with an absence of a process, you do get these kind of strange statements like the president has been made aware of the deployment of Marines to Syria.
Are we trying to make Turkey happy? Or are we not trying to make Turkey happy? Are we trying to make Russia happy? Are we not trying to make Russia happy?
And also, I mean, you know, we can come up with a bunch of other things, too, in terms of the non-existence of the process, ranging from no response to North Korea.
This is going to be a fascinating four-year experiment in what it is like to have no government. This is going to be awesome for libertarians. We're going to spend money and yet have no government.
This is Bannon's vision of things. But North Korea happened. There was no response to North Korea. Now, this week, we've seen this other bizarre thing, which was Mexico's foreign minister it's last week, folks, because when we recorded this. But the Mexican foreign minister came to Washington and didn't inform the State Department, apparently.
Tillerson was made aware of it after the fact by the media.
And met with the White House, didn't meet with the State Department. This is you know, the whole reason the NSC exists is to ensure that everybody knows what's going on.
Yeah. I think one thing is, there's been lots of reports on this, but, you know, Trump is a homebody. And he also gets kind of bored. And so he always
interestingly,
wants people...
his home isn't the White House. You know, it's Mar-a-Lago.
So, but in essence,
his wife and children's home is somewhere
else. To the
degree
that he's involved in the national security process at all, it appears to be to regularly host dinners with some subset of his cabinet. Obviously, this was done most infamously in the lead up to the Yemen raid, but all the reports suggest he continues to do this. So, you know, a couple times a week, he has cabinet members over for dinner and they have conversations on these things. Who knows what gets discussed there? The only common denominator, though, appear to be the president himself, Jared Kushner is his son-in-law, Steve Bannon, sometimes Reince Priebus. It's not clear if H.R. McMaster attends any
sometimes
of these
Ivanka.
And you know, one gets the sense that a lot of things are brought to him and he either kind of says, yeah, that sounds fine or not without a lot of deliberation. And that can be empowering for the cabinet officials who then go off and do their thing. But it's also a way to create all sorts of mistakes. And I'm also not clear that Rex Tillerson gets invited to very many of these things. I mean, I think Mattis has been given a lot of authority.
We should invite Rex Tillerson to dinner at the Deep State Cafe.
Wasn't there a story when Trump was having dinner at the Trump Hotel with Farage? Tillerson
at
was like at a table,
booth.
Like at the little kids'
looking over
table,
his shoulder next, every next, now and then. Exactly. Sadly.
And Farage was a last-minute guest, and they made space for him. They didn't make space for Tillerson. Yeah. I feel bad for the poor
But there
guy.
Is always room for you, Rex, here at the Deep State Cafe.
Right. If he hadn't raped the environment of the planet for the rest of the entirety
of his
career.
Hey, he's the only guy in the Trump administration who believes that climate change is real. You got to take what you can get.
Oh, yeah, compared to Pruitt, who doesn't believe in man-made climate change.
Well, when you've seen it firsthand how humans can change the environment.
Right.
When you've changed
it. That's right. We've been changing the climate for the past 100 years since John D. Rockefeller got us going. It's an excellent point. Well, you know, the way Trump runs the government is not it's certainly not like a president, right? These dinners it's an interesting phenomenon. It's a little bit more like a king. And you know what it reminds me of is a book called The Emperor by Richard Kapuscinski. Mm-hmm. Which is a story of Haile Selassie.
Yes, an excellent book.
It's an excellent book, and it's short, ER listener, very short book, so you can go and read it. But one of the things that was interesting about it was that what would happen is people would come in and they would present themselves to Haile Selassie, the Ethiopian emperor, and they would say things like, my cow died, or my neighbor's, you know, tractor ran over my cow. And then the emperor would listen, and periodically he would turn to the guy to his right and he would whisper something in his ear, and the guy would write something down. And then after the meeting, the guy would walk outside the room and he would announce to everybody, a new cow will be presented to so-and-so, or whatever, you know, came out of the notebook that he was reading from. And this guy, who had no official title in the government, came to be known as the Minister of the Pen. And he was the most powerful guy because no one heard what the president whispered to him. And he was able to walk out and say, this is what the president wants. And there are all these people who are around the president who are essentially ministers of the pen.
Or at least who are vying for that job, but they're all asserting
that they have that job. Stephen Miller and Sebastian Gorka and Stephen Bannon and all those people are going around going, well, I speak for the White House, for the president, for this, you know, mystical.
That's an interesting idea. I think we here in the Deep State Cafe should simply start doing the same thing ourselves. We should just start asserting policy initiatives on behalf of the Trump administration. That might be as effective as anything coming out of the White House.
Well, I do think you're having this. You have these two rival camps. I think of them as the axis of ideologues versus the axis of adults. The axis of ideologues being kind of Bannon, Miller, Gorka, Anton, who's kind of the new Ben Rhodes position over in the West Wing.
That's not very nice. We've been tough on Ben Rhodes, but that's not nice to Ben Rhodes.
Right. I'm saying he's not the new Ben Rhodes. He's the new Ben Rhodes position at the White House. But folks basically who, you know, because of their proximity to the Oval Office, or in Bannon's case, because you're the first and last person in the room with the president on a lot of things, you're able to advance an agenda through the president and claiming to speak for the president or call people up on the phone and speak for the president that's quite ideological, that's at odds with our values, that threatens our allies, that undermines our global leadership. So that's kind of the axis of ideologues. Then you kind of have the adults. You know, you have Mattis, you have Tillerson, who's an adult, although somewhat disempowered at the moment. There's Pence, Kelly, and Pompeo, and others. And I've heard that they're basically all talking to one another and actually trying to come to some agreement on things.
How do we get this guy to pay attention?
And I think what we're going to see in the coming year, and frankly over the next 4 years, if he's president for that long, is which one of these camps ultimately ends up winning out. And it's clear which one that would be better for the country, but I don't know which one.
Well, but I have to say, this deserves a little bit further scrutiny. You know, I agree there's the ideologues, and there are a couple kinds of ideologues within the ideologues. There's the wacky, insane, out-of-control libertarians a la Bannon who just want to blow up the government and so forth. There's also some hard-right conservative ideologues on a number of issues. But in terms of the grown-ups, this was an appellation that was bestowed on these people a little bit too quickly in my book. And, you know, Jim Kelly, he was like, this guy's going to be a grown-up. And I see no traces of grown-up supervision of U.S. immigration policy, border policy.
Yeah, that is true.
And you had him out defending. You had him out defending this rumor, basically, that they were going to separate women and their children at the borders as a deterrent mechanism for immigration, which was unconscionable.
And bizarre,
because normally in the government, perhaps too often, you have the public affairs people saying, oh, no, you do not want to say that. You really don't want to have your picture taken as you drag some poor guy out of the hospital where he's just had surgery to deport him, or out of the hypothermia shelter at church, or yank a child away from their parent. That is not a good photo opportunity for you. And even that doesn't seem to be happening.
I don't see a lot of grown-up supervision at DHS. And then another grown-up is McMaster. And everybody has high regard for McMaster. But the first big battle McMaster made was with in this non-state of the union, state of the union that Trump made about the issue of whether you refer to it as Islamic terrorism or not. And McMaster lost on that issue. He's apparently not having a real good time getting rid of what I'm told is referred to as the Flintstones, you know, the Mike Flynn former staffers within the place. He's hiring a couple of his own people who are somewhat credible people. But, you know, we see this. You know, I was thinking about it when we heard that John Huntsman had been named to be ambassador to Moscow. And you think, well, John Huntsman's a well-meaning, well-intentioned guy and patriotic and is taking this job because he thinks it'll help. But on the other hand, You know, we've seen Tillerson get used. We've seen Kelly get used. We've seen McMaster get sort of bumped aside. And at a certain point, some of these grownups realize that their beards, that they're being used, that the NSC is being a front for the SIG.
They're Potemkin cabinet members.
It's a Potemkin NSC, and that there is this Potemkin NSC that has a little bit of process, not so much, not so often, and all the real stuff is happening someplace else. Or am I overstating that?
I might push back in one area. I think that the place where, I don't think DOD is being used, for example. I mean, I actually think that Jim Mattis and Joe Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, have a lot of schwack in this administration.
Schwack. What does that mean, Colin? Could you define that?
The ability to get things done, to get their way, if anything, I think basically the DOD has been given a pretty broad set of authorities and told to just go get them. And they're doing that. That's how they started this show. I also think that, Trump said he was going to rely on his generals. He now has a host of his generals around him. I also think it's really hard for them to ultimately check Mattis too much, because he's one of the two or three people in the entire government right now Trump can't fire. So I actually do, while I don't think that there's a lot of demonstrated influence thus far for Kelly and certainly for Tillerson, we've talked about, I do think at DOD. The one thing I would say for McMaster, I do get the sense that one of the reasons why the revised executive order on the travel ban was even incrementally better by taking the Iraqis out is that McMaster fought for that. So that's good. Doesn't mean that the EO doesn't suck. It's terrible. But at least it doesn't have the Iraqis in it.
Yeah. Well, that's right. But also,
besides that, Mrs. Yeah. Lincoln, how was
the right? The EO is just the beginning of the tip of the iceberg. I've been sitting here going, SWAC should be Superhuman World Affairs Control or something. I want to try turn it into an acronym at some point. We'll take suggestions for the acronym, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of demand for the I've got a lot of SWAC mug.
that sounds a little obscene.
It
does. I don't think we should say that anymore on the show.
Okay, I'm sorry. I don't mean to make this. This is a safe space, resident. Yeah. I apologize.
It's a microaggression.
I was just going to go there.
Ouch.
Yeah, can you imagine if they didn't? I mean, the Trump White House must be the most.
It's just macro aggression, isn't it?
I mean,
they do everything huge. They don't do
these
micro.
Stories.
Come
he
on.
Blows up. He yells at people. I've talked to some folks who, I've talked to some of the people we've just named, who say they spend most of their time sort of talking the boss off the ledge.
Yeah, well, that's. I mean, I guess. Contra, Colin, your somewhat glass half full optimistic theory of the case here. It seems to me that people like Kelly and Mattis so far have devoted approximately 2/3 of their time not to doing anything in particular that's constructive, but just trying to undo the damage done by some of the crazier things that Trump and Bannon, et cetera, say, to have to reassure, oh, no, we're not abandoning Japan. Oh, no, we're not abandoning now. Oh, just kidding. No, he didn't really mean that. Don't worry. And that's not a great use of those guys. I mean, it's good for America and good for the world that they're trying to calm people down, but it that's not independence. And I do worry. I mean, your example about McMaster having potentially slightly lessened the awfulness of the new executive order, could cut the other way, which is that these are people who are very highly respected. And viewed as people of real integrity. And it's, this is the story of a lot of horrific things that have happened historically in many places, that good people get co-opted and they tell themselves, well, I made this, 2% better than it would have been without me. But then, time goes on.
There's other ramifications, because I'm going to keep pushing back on the grown-up thing until somebody starts behaving like a grown-up. We've set aside.
It's not going to be me,
Kelly.
God damn it.
We knew that. That's why you're here. But we can set aside Kelly in that regard. And I think we set aside Tillerson because he's, absent without leave. And then. We turn to Mattis, and certainly Mattis has done some positive things on torture and so forth. We felt a little bit. But here's the thing. Mattis and Dunford ought to know better at this point that when you start deploying troops into situations when you don't have a strategic goal, that leads you into a problem. And so to some extent, they're acting on the in the way that is consistent, perhaps, with the views of others in the Pentagon, and may make sense in a tactical sense, but it's not a grown-up move.
Well,
to go and argue that we should put troops.
We don't know. They may have strategic goals. They just have not been shared with the rest of us.
Except you can't achieve strategic goals in Syria militarily. The United States can't. It requires political collaboration, which is not happening.
Yeah.
And, you know, the natural next step in Syria is you go in, you win in Raqqa. You may, you know, push ISIS out into some of the cracks within the system there. And this sort of Syrian opposition remains fragmented and too weak to do anything. So Assad plus the Russians will get as much control as they can. And the Turks plus perhaps some of the other players of that sort will start saying, no, the issue here is the Kurds. And we've got to start pushing back on the Kurds who helped us. And now we're, you know, we don't need their help anymore. And we're not, that's not a wonderful strategic outcome.
Yeah. Look, I think that, you know, a lot of it depends on how one defines strategy. Look, I think that they have a vision. They at the Pentagon have a vision that came up through this strategy review. It was called a strategy review for the 30-day
one. Well, it's called a strategy review, and they've got to have a strategy.
But it was that they have a vision.
You mean like the Strategic Initiatives Group?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have a vision for what the next step in the counter-ISIS campaign should be. I think they are very worried and understand the huge dilemmas in what we want to do with Raqqa and what that does vis-a-vis our relationship with the Turks. And I think they are working overdrive to try to come up with a set of military and political compensatory measures to reassure the Turks, even as we, in essence, arm and train their mortal enemies, this group, the YPG, Kurds that are associated with PKK, who are fighting and blowing up Turks every single day. I think they are aware of that. What I think they have not shown any sign of doing is whatever one thinks of the play they are going to run, of connecting it to this to the broader challenge of Syria. So and that's a hard problem. But it requires them making some fundamental decisions about what is their play vis-a-vis the Russians? Are they going to try to cooperate with the Russians or not? Are they going to increase or decrease pressure on the regime? Are they willing to talk to the Iranians, where you can't have a political solution in Syria without talking to the Iranians, or just keep them on notice and put pressure on them all across the region? There's a whole bunch of interconnected diplomatic issues. And then they raise the question of who would then carry out that diplomacy, since Rex Tillerson has not been terribly effective to date, and he doesn't have a deputy, and he doesn't have a bunch of key people.
Well,
and General Botel, apparently.
But you know, well, yeah, except, you know, we'll get to him in a second. But you know, this gets us into another problem. This was an area that I think we were correctly critical of the Obama administration on, although we've debated this here with Derek Chollet in the past, and I suspect it'll happen again. And that is, I don't think the Obama administration was very strategic in the region, and you can't take Syria out of the context of Iraq, and you can't take Syria and Iraq out of the context of Iran. And this administration is going to go hard at Iran. And, you know, after Mosul, you know, then they're going to be faced with the question of, you know, how do you deal with a government in Baghdad that is primarily controlled by the government of Iran? And Iran has a particularly large stake in this. And then on top of all of that, just to, you know, take it another stake, go beat ISIS. You know, we could go back, you know, in history, could look back on the period from certainly 2001 through now as the, you know, through and maybe for the next 20 years as the whack-a-mole wars, where we go in, find a terrorist group, go after the terrorist group, defeat the terrorist group, create a void where another terrorist group crops up. They grow. They become a different kind of a threat, and we go after them. And, you know, I think one has to be strategic in terms of the stabilization of the region, which is political, and you have to be strategic in terms of countering extremism in the region, which, again, is a different kind of strategy. And somehow you've got to get your security types who are dealing with extremism and your political types who and by the way, your economic types, because you've got to rebuild all these countries to the tune of $200-300 billion, for which we have not even begun to have that discussion. All of those things have got to be aligned to actually stabilize.
Well, I don't think President Trump, at least, has any interest in the stabilization piece of this or the rebuilding piece. I think that, you know, when you decide that you're going to slash the State Department and the foreign aid budget by 37%, I think manifestly you're announcing that you don't really care. Après moi, le déluge. Yeah. You know, we're going to kill the people we want to kill, and then
well, that's
you
why
figure
all the military
out,
people who you know you yeah. guys know well, you know, screamed about that because in time after time in Iraq and in Afghanistan, the military people ended up giving missions that they thought should have gone to development people or they thought should have gone.
No, I think that's right. Although I have heard that in his calls, for example, with some of our traditional Arab partners and allies, you know, he has been basically signaling that Trump has been signaling that our expectation is they would pony up more resources, cash basically to pay for safe zones and other things in Syria. Look, I think David, you're right on the following score. Sometime in 2017, we're going to be at a post-Mosul moment in Iraq and a post-Raqqa moment in Syria. And that is really the inflection point for a set of political arrangements that will have to be put in place and thought through now, or you will get, you know, ISIS 2.0 or 3.0
right.
or 4.0.
That's the what's next moment.
That's right. And the challenge is, it's not clear to me they are thinking through those next moves, period. But I'm also disturbed by the fact that to the degree that I can discern a play from them, it's to go very hard against the Iranians and to, in essence, write a blank check for our traditional allies and partners in the region, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Egyptians, and others. And this could actually end up the combination of these things, of going hard at the Iranians and giving a blank check to the Emirates and the Saudis. I think you can interpret Yemen in this context, for example, could actually end up kind of pouring gasoline on the sectarian challenges across the region that will make post-Mosul and post-Raqqa issues more difficult. The Iranians are bad guys. They do a lot of bad stuff, and we should push back against that. But the notion that you can resolve what Iraq looks like after Mosul or what Syria looks like after Raqqa without having a sustained dialogue with the Iranians is a fantasy.
Well, and also that you can try and take this out of the context. I mean, what you just explained makes a lot of sense, and I think that is the direction that it's going. But then it doesn't deal with the inherent Iranian paradox, which is Iraq, which is we need them to keep the, you know, ISIS down in Iraq, and they control the government in Iraq to some considerable extent right now. And if we go hard at them someplace, they're not going to be so helpful in the other place. It doesn't deal with Syria, and where there's the Russia component and Iran component and the Turkey component plus the Kurdish component. It doesn't deal with Lebanon and Israel, where you've got the Iranian component through Hezbollah in Lebanon, which may heat up depending on what happens in Syria. And you've, of course, got Hamas in Israel, which has also got an Iranian component. And if the administration goes hard right on Israel with Friedman and the other people and start embracing some of the Bibi stuff, we're likely to heat that up, which is yet another problem. We haven't gotten into Egypt, where they are giving a blank check, and Sisi is an issue, but Sisi and the Gulf states are all going to say, let's go hard after the Muslim yeah. Brotherhood, which, in addition to alienating the people in Qatar and Turkey that have been underwriting the Muslim Brotherhood, is going to create another set of problems. In other words, this is the region where the song, you know, the knee bone's connected to the shin bone.
And we're setting ourselves up for any number of collisions. And one thing that I think will be very interesting is another potential outcome of what seems to be a divided executive branch, the Pentagon moving in a different direction in some ways than the White House, is what happens when an approach pursued by the Pentagon, which is very, very likely to make Russia very, very angry at some point fairly soon, collides with the approach that seems to be being taken by the White House, which is let's be pals, best pals with Vladimir Putin. What happens when Putin does get mad?
Well,
be very interesting question.
I also think that there's another scenario there which also involves Russia, which could be a little bit worse. And that scenario is that what Trump wants is to be able to declare victory in ISIS and get the hell out. And he wants the other people to assume responsibility. And the Gulf states will assume responsibility, and they will win in Yemen, and they will push back on Iran, and they will stabilize that part of the world to some extent. In Syria, the way that the Syrian government is going to assume responsibility is with the aid of the Russians. And the Russians are going to go in and, as they have, try to strengthen their ties with the Egyptians. And the Russians are going to gain considerable amount of influence in this part of the world, filling a void created by us, while simultaneously because they don't really have a goal of stabilizing this, and we haven't a strategy for stabilizing it. The refugee flows are going to continue to Europe. And with the refugee flows continuing to Europe, you're going to continue to strengthen the right in Europe, which is going to continue to weaken the Atlantic Alliance, which the Trump administration is also embracing.
Right.
And so through a policy of embracing the weakening of the Atlantic Alliance and empowering Russia, Russia's strategic goal of greater influence in the Middle East and a weaker Atlantic Alliance is going to make big headway. And our strategic goals of having a strong Atlantic Alliance and a stable Middle East will not be advanced. And that seems to me to be, you know, one of those big geopolitical watershed mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's for Putin, it's heads I win, tails you lose, in the sense that either they get cooperation with the Trump administration that advances their goals, or they just get a discombobulated, non-strategic, but highly divisive Trump administration that fractures, erodes, undermines the Western liberal order, and particularly our alliances with the Europeans, in which case Putin wins. It was like during the election, you know, he wanted to hurt Clinton, help Trump, but just cause chaos, if nothing else. And, you know, he was okay with any of those outcomes. I do think in Syria, David, that you're seeing largely as a consequence of events on the ground where these de facto zones of control are emerging. The Russians, the Iranians, and Assad have essentially consolidated the regime's control of the western spine of the parts of the country Assad cares about the most. The Jordanians and opposition groups have, in essence, carved out a buffer zone in the south. The Turks have a little pocket in between two large Kurdish areas in the northwest. And the Americans, we have, in essence, planted our flag in the north, central, and northeastern parts of the country in the consequence of the counter ISIS campaign. I think after Raqqa, there is a possibility of, in essence, taking the facts on the ground and turning it into a decentralized arrangement that both provides a ceasefire and potentially a political settlement that, if not getting rid of Assad, diffuses power away from the central government. It will be extraordinarily tough. It will require doing things the Trump administration won't want to do, like talk to the Iranians. It may involve a strategic look where you're trying to make trades in places like Syria for things that are going on in other parts of the region, whether it be Israel and the Golan, or whether it be Yemen, or intersections between Syria and Iraq. So you're right that this has to be looked at holistically. It's not clear to me that they are doing that. I wouldn't pretend the Obama administration got this right either. We tended to look at it on an issue-by-issue basis. These folks not only look at it from an issue-by-issue basis, but they're not even attempting to look at it.
Well, and also, this is a part of the world where if you had to bet on one player, you know, bet on chaos.
Yeah.
And if you had to bet on somebody other than chaos, bet on the one who's willing to fight hardest and play dirtiest. In other words, you know, because the one that's going to be willing to use force. And in the case of Syria, Assad plus Russia, or as it suits them, Assad plus Russia plus Iran, are going to be able to have the edge in every place where there isn't a really well-organized alternative.
Yeah, but I think they've run out of Schlitz, frankly. I think they may be able to
Schlitz,
get
Schlitz, out of Schwack.
Right,
boy.
I got it. Yeah, no, I mean, look, I think that they are approaching the limits of what they can take back at reasonable cost. They just took back Palmyra for the second time. They have this little outpost in the eastern part of the country called Deir ez-Zor, which they will probably try to defend. But the Assad regime, even with the Russians and the Iranians and Hezbollah, cannot take back the whole country.
I don't think they can do it right now.
But I do think there's one thing I should mention. I do think we have incredible amounts of leverage. But it would require the Trump administration to get beyond their rhetorical disdain for nation building. And it's the following. What the Russians and the Iranians and Assad do care about is being able to hold and rebuild the part of the country along the Western spine, which will cost hundreds of billions of dollars. And only the United States can help marshal the resources for that. So we shouldn't – that's a huge piece of leverage that we have over future political arrangements in Syria if they play it right.
First of all, I think that the chances that the United States will do that are essentially zero. I do think that both with regard to that particular solution, but more broadly with regard to the stabilization of the region, the $64,000 question is actually a maybe $600 billion question, which is how do you pay for rebuilding Yemen? How do you pay for rebuilding Iraq? How do you pay for rebuilding Syria? How do you pay for rebuilding Libya? How do you pay for the infrastructure that's going to be necessary to create a functioning Palestine, et cetera? That's hundreds of billions of dollars. There is no development institution within the Middle East to do that. The Islamic Development Bank doesn't do that. It's not their business. There is a need for something along the lines of the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. And that actually gets us to an interesting place in all of this conversation, which came up in the peace game that we recently did in Abu Dhabi. And that is, look over the course of the next 10 years for China to play an increasingly important role in this part of the world. As they start needing money, they start needing infrastructure, and the Chinese can play the weakness and the lack of leadership from other countries into something like that kind of a bank where they put in money. And, you know, it doesn't work with the northern Syria portion or the portion of this equation, but with all the rest of it, the Gulfies would put in money next to the Chinese, others would put in money, and you could end up with something. And I think it's not an economic development piece. It's a strategic piece.
Yeah. I think the Chinese historically, if you look at their investments in Africa and elsewhere, you know, they're more inclined to make investments where they think they can get mercantile gains in terms of natural resources. That doesn't play out very well in Syria, but it may in places like Iraq or Libya.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think around the Gulf and the infrastructure of the Gulf, and if you look at it with Israel, with Saudi, with Pakistan, with many of the countries in the region, China is now the number one or number two trading partner. So they do have a stake in all of this. Well, look, it's very clear that the three of us could solve this if we were given the authority to do it.
If only this podcast lasted for a little bit longer, we could solve this.
But we were very close.
We were close.
Yeah. I think we were close enough that any listener could tell that we could solve this if we were given that amount of latitude. And, you know, who knows? You know, tune in for another one of these ER podcasts. We may actually solve this problem, or we may move on to other even more complicated problems, like, for example, a unified theory of physics.
Yeah.
Or something, you know, explaining the popularity of the Kardashians. But in any event, those are things that we will save for future podcasts. In the meantime, thank you, Colin. Thank you, Rosa. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back sometime soon. You have been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, and I have been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori with the assistance of Alex Dorr. For more information about FP and to subscribe to The ER and our Global Thinkers podcast, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, or Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you very much for joining us.